My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to this final session on stress management. In this session, we'll discuss what heals in psychotherapy, the avenues to inner peace, and a recap of all the tools we have discussed so far in this program. Now, what heals in therapy? It's important to understand the final common pathway. If clients have experienced relief in their symptoms as a result of therapy or by any other means, they have undergone certain changes deep inside their mind. And these changes are common to all forms of psychotherapy. There is an ultimate change process that underlies all forms of therapy, and it happens naturally as well without therapy. Different therapies play different roles at different stages of this change process. All forms of therapies can be divided into two broad categories: one that work at the conscious level and the other at the unconscious. Therapies that work at the conscious level are counseling, psychoeducation, cognitive therapies, and to some extent behavioral therapies. They help clients identify the unrealistic elements in their thinking and replace those with more realistic ones, or they fill the gaps in our awareness with knowledge and information that can be used to manage our stress better. The second broad category is that of therapies that work at the unconscious level, and this includes mainly psychoanalysis, mindfulness meditation, experiential therapies, and existential therapy. The stages of change that are involved in the final common pathway are: first, activation of the past experience from the unconscious mind by a number of different techniques. With cognitive behavioral therapies, clients are exposed to a situation that is stress producing, either in imagination or in the real world. With Vipassana meditation and mindfulness meditation, clients are asked to focus their attention on their inner body sensations, which leads to activation of certain past experiences. With psychoanalysis, clients are encouraged to be in a sensory deprivation state and let go of the conscious ways of thinking called free association, which brings out information about the past from the unconscious. Whereas in other forms of therapies, clients are encouraged to revisit their troubled past, and this opens up issues that have not been worked on so far. Once those emotions are activated, the next step is to stay connected with them, no matter how stressful they are, as this is essential for them to get worked on. Seeking distractions and escaping from the inner distress makes one lose the opportunity to work on them. The third step is to understand those emotionally charged experiences from the past in a different way, that is, using the corrective therapeutic experience. This reliving of a past emotion is important for it to get worked on, and our newly learned skills help us deal with the distress that comes with reliving them. This is akin to a behavioral therapy technique called systematic desensitization, where clients learn to work through a hierarchy of stressful situations in their imagination. They first imagine the least stressful situation and make themselves anxious and are then asked to relax so that they can master the anxiety. Once mastered, they move on to imagining more stressful situations from the hierarchy and learn to master them. In psychoanalysis, an intellectual understanding is used to make sense of the symptoms and find meaning in them. And this knowledge or insight results in healing. In experiential therapies and mindfulness meditation, a holding on to a non-judgmental and neutral attitude brings about inner healing as stress dissolves in an equanimous mind. The therapies that work at the conscious level are also about letting go of unrealistic goals and desires, building a healing and trusting relationship with therapist, and learning new ways of coping. By using the final common pathway, one learns that different therapies are not in conflict with each other, but can work together with each other. The only conflict would be between therapies that suppress the unconscious and the therapies that uncover the unconscious. These two should not be mixed together. Therapy is generally about eliminating the negative emotion, which results in experience of inner peace. But there are other avenues to inner peace as well, such as solitude, detachment, letting go, and surrender. There are two types of happiness. The first is the happiness of the external world, which is dependent upon having possessions and being in relationships. And the other is the happiness of the inner world, which is not dependent upon anything in particular. And it's about self-rejoicing in itself. If we can let go of our preoccupations with the external happiness, there are adequate compensations for that. That is, it gets replaced with inner peace. I say that a part of the mind should not be involved in the politics of everyday life. By politics, I mean affairs of everyday life. Whether your neighbor is nice or nasty, whether your children are obedient or not, whether your grandchildren are doing well at school or not, whether you are in good health or not, whether you are rich or poor, whether you are in relationship or not. The part of the mind that doesn't get sucked into this politics of everyday life is open to receiving inner peace from within. Being in solitude can facilitate this process. Solitude can be therapeutic only when one has got the inner resources to make use of it. Otherwise, it can increase one's stress levels. A simple test to find that out is to ask yourself, how do you feel when you are on your own and you have nothing much to do, in comparison to times when you are busy with things and are with people? There are two categories of people who would be comfortable with their own company. First, those who are uncomfortable in the company of others and choose to be on their own because that causes less discomfort. For these people, seeking solitude would be an escape from a distressing external situation. The second category of people is those for whom solitude is a positive experience. They enjoy being on their own as they feel connected with their deeper or divine sense of self and draw nourishment from it. This second category of people do enjoy the company of others, but they equally enjoy being on their own, if not more. It's therefore important to find out which category you belong to. If you are seeking company of others because you find it difficult to be on your own, then seeking of solitude would be described as escapism. Similarly, if one is seeking solitude because one is uncomfortable being with others, that would also be escapism. It's therefore important to learn both these skills, that is, people skill and solitude skill. If you ask me which is the most important skill that one should learn in life, then my answer would be solitude skill. That is, learning to be okay with one's own self when nothing much is happening in one's life. Because at the end of the day, everything that gives you happiness is not guaranteed to be with you at all times. And any separation from them is bound to make you unhappy. You are truly happy only to the extent you have made your happiness free-floating. That is, independent of external conditions. And to some extent, also independent of your thoughts and feelings, which are constantly going through change. We'll now do a recap of all the coping strategies that we have discussed in this program. I call them tools at your disposal. To begin with, the first tool is to keep in mind that whatever one is experiencing through one's five senses and one's thoughts and feelings at any given moment in time is temporary. There's no need to bring any special thoughts to the mind, but whatever is already happening or going on in the stream of consciousness has to be seen as temporary, short term. This is neither a denial nor a nihilistic way of looking, but understanding things in their true nature and accepting the fact that everything changes constantly. This allows at least a part of the mind to stand outside itself and to start observing. It's like stepping outside the experience so that we can manage it better. The second tool is fine-tuning one's judgment so that they fall in line with the reality. The majority of psychiatric symptoms involve a distortion of one's reality, and the goal of therapy is to get them closer to it so that their thinking and actions are appropriate and realistic. For this to happen, at least part of the mind should remain in an equanimous or neutral state, because only an equanimous mind can see the reality as it is. An emotionally charged mind can't perceive the reality as it is. In a happy state of mind, we remain in denial of the negative, and in an unhappy state, we remain in denial of the positive or exaggerate the negative. A denial of the reality means not being aware of the reality. And if that be so, how can we deal with it properly? Denial of the reality is the first step towards its distortion, which paves the way for creation of more symptoms. So the second coping mechanism or tool is to challenge all our judgments with a view to fine-tuning them. The third tool is to disidentify with our ghost emotions, the experiences that don't belong to our current situation and to our personalities. These should be treated as mere thoughts or mere emotions, although they may have real consequences if we don't understand their true nature and start identifying with them. This coping mechanism also involves identifying thoughts, feelings, perceptions, experiences that don't truly belong to our personality. The catchphrase here is, "This is not the real me." The fourth tool is writing an emotion diary, and have explained elsewhere the theoretical rationale behind it and how it can work. The website www.undoyourstress.com has all the details. The fifth tool is manipulation of one's attention so that one lives in the present moment. And there are a number of different techniques, the most important being awareness of the breath. Breath is something that is happening in the present right now. And its awareness doesn't involve any thoughts and feelings. And by paying attention to one's breath for prolonged periods of time, one learns how to control one's mind. The mind has a tendency to dwell on different thoughts and feelings. And awareness of one's own breathing gives clients the ability to pull their attention away from whatever thought, feelings they are experiencing at any given moment. I normally give an example of weightlifting. When you lift a weight and drop it, again lift it and drop it, the weight has a tendency to go down and you are lifting it against its normal tendency on a constant basis. And this leads to strengthening of your muscles, although the weight is still there at its original place at the end of the session. In a similar fashion, the mind wanders into different thoughts and feelings from the past or the future. And when you pull it back to your breath again and again, against its normal tendency to dwell on thoughts and feelings, you are learning to make your mental muscles strong. This exercise also gives clients a greater ability to stop their thoughts and feelings at will if they don't want to have them and transfer their attention in the direction they want to work. The sixth tool is breath regulation, which involves different kinds of breathing, such as paced breathing and abdominal breathing, and we have discussed how it brings about a harmony between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. The seventh tool is that of use of biofeedback devices such as light and sound machine and stress eraser. The use of light and sound machines leads to changes in one's brainwave pattern with the objective of achieving a relaxed and tranquil state, whereas stress eraser leads to increased heart rate variability by way of bringing one's respiration in harmony with their heart rhythm. There are a number of other biofeedback devices that one can use for specific disorders and symptoms. The eighth tool is that of using an existential approach to understand the true nature of our inner being and the reality of the external world. This includes a discussion on issues such as death, ultimate meaning in relationships, the extent to which we are free to act, and the sense of responsibility that goes with it. The responsibility for one's own emotions and dealing effectively with them. Existentialism not only helps us understand the world better, but encourages us to engage properly with it and create new meanings in life. Existentialism does not believe that there is a meaning lying out there for you to discover, but it's your responsibility to create the meaning through your own actions. This links in with the next tool of coping, and I call it creating positive issues out of nothing. You must have come across people who create negative issues out of nothing. Things that are non-issues are made issues by them, creating a ripple of stress in their surroundings. When I say creating negative issues out of nothing, I mean the emotional response or physical action of the individual is not a logical response to a given situation, or others would not have been aware of it in the absence of the person. In a similar fashion, one can think of being the person who creates positive issues out of nothing, which means that one is not passively responding to situations one is thrown into, but they are able to create new situations, new thinking, new ideas, new activities that will create a ripple effect of happiness in their surroundings and within themselves. Creating a positive issue could be a solitary pursuit or a social activity, depending upon one's preference, and it could include a wide variety of activities. It could mean what Joseph Campbell has described, follow your bliss. It could mean pursuing your hobbies, interests that you always wanted to do but kept it on the back burner due to the commitments of everyday life. It could mean creating a playlist of songs that you like most on your iPod, that is, songs that were given 5-star rating by you, and playing them at certain specified times for specific purposes. I know of clients who play 10-minute music in their car before going to work, and they tell me that it transfers them to a different level of consciousness, and they are feeling more ready to take on the world when they arrive at their workplace. It could mean sharing more of yourself with your partner or people close to you. It could mean creating new intimacies in relationships by way of self-disclosure, stopping short of feeling vulnerable. It could mean visiting places where you spent your childhood and college days with your partner, or traveling to places of one's choice, limited only by one's imagination. The 10th tool can be described as social therapy, which is quite different from working on one's own negative emotions. A harmonious connection with other human beings is a therapy in itself. There are times you'll find that none of the tools discussed here is working. You say to yourself, everything is temporary. The emotion you are experiencing is also temporary. You're not making any judgments about it. You see it as a ghost emotion. Still, you are not able to shift the emotion, and it's making you feel miserable. You have written about it in your diary to make sense of the experience. You have done your breathing exercises. You have been on the biofeedback machine as well. And you don't feel like pursuing your hobbies or interest. And the music also doesn't liven you up. What do you do in those circumstances? One of the tools that can work in these situations is just being with the other person you feel close to. You don't have to do anything for each other or say anything to the other person, but just spending some time with other human beings can be helpful. Some amount of psychic energy or vibes get exchanged when we just be with the other person. If you feel down in the dumps, then human contact with others can be a rope which can help you pull yourself out of dumps. The 11th tool is that of altruism. I won't go into the details of altruism as most people understand what it means. But I'll simply discuss how it can help us with stress management. If you feel helpless and unfortunate, then the knowledge that there are a lot of people out there who are more helpless and more unfortunate than you can be helpful. A friend of mine questioned this and said, for example, I am blind in one eye, and the knowledge that there is another person who is also blind or more blind than me will not give me back my vision. So how does it help? To think that there are other people suffering as well in this world will not take away my suffering. And my answer to that was, agreed, you have vision only in one eye, and that is causing you enormous unhappiness. But if you knew that everybody in this world, or nearly 90% of the population, leaving aside those who have transcended human nature, has only one eye, then it might ease your pain to some extent. That is what existentialism tells us, that at the end of the day, whatever unhappiness you are going through, others have gone through similar unhappiness of some sort, or maybe more. And if they have not experienced it, it's as yet. Eventually, they will experience similar suffering. We all suffer from the same condition, and that is to be a human being. And we all are blessed with the same blessing, and that is to be a human being. We are all in the same boat. Some worry about sinking in the sea, whereas others think about reaching their destination. It is the law of nature that whenever we create a feeling of caring or love for the other human beings, it has a positive effect on our own psyche as well. Whenever we have a feeling or intention of helping people or increasing their happiness, immediately it creates a positive emotion in our own minds as well, which is deeply satisfying. And if we are able to carry out an act of altruism, it increases the feeling further. If one is not able to undo one's negative emotions because one doesn't have enough psychological reserve or the strength to deal with them, then these little acts of altruism can increase the reserve to a point where one feels ready to take on the negative emotions and neutralize them. Before one performs a charitable act, it's very important to test one's own mind as to what effect it's having on one's inner being. If by performing the external act, one feels that it has caused inner distress, then one is not ready for it. It should be performed only when it's accompanied by a positive feeling deep inside. And for that, one has to be mindful not just of how much is going away from them, but what feelings are created inside oneself, and to strike a balance between the two. Finally, the 12th tool is that of detachment, or being indifferent to this world. Now, generally, these two words are used in a negative way in our daily conversation, but here they are being used to convey something positive. Detachment here does not mean adopting an uncaring or indifferent attitude to people, or that they don't mean anything to you. It means cutting off one's insecure attachments, which create a lot of neurotic anxiety. It's a selfless way of relating to others, where one doesn't worry about how much is coming towards them, but how much is flowing out of them. If that be the case, then the insecurity disappears, because the love for other human beings moves on to a higher level of maturity. Finally, I have a question. If I were to ask you today that your life will be frozen from now on for eternity, which means not an iota will change from how things are right now, will life be acceptable to you? If you don't have a partner, you will not have a partner for eternity. If you don't have enough money, you'll not have enough money for eternity. If you suffer from an illness, that illness will stay with you for eternity. If you have difficult relationships, those difficulties will continue for eternity. If your children are still small, they will remain small for eternity. Your age will remain frozen for eternity. If you are a young adult or an old man, you will remain so for eternity. Will life be acceptable to you? If your answer is yes, then perhaps life has treated you fairly and you have managed your life well. But if your answer to this question is no, which would mean your acceptance of human life is not perfect, fair enough. Nothing wrong with this. It's quite normal. But I want you to visualize a scenario where I come back to you in a couple of years' time and ask you the same question. Is life acceptable to you? And I hope you'd have done certain things in those 2 years so that your acceptance of life has moved on. I take this opportunity to express my gratitude to a number of teachers who have guided me over the years and helped me understand the theory and practice of psychotherapy. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. S.N. Goenka, my Vipassana teacher, who taught me Vipassana meditation, which has helped me a lot, both personally and professionally. I'm thankful to Mr. S.N. Tandon, who taught me how to put a non-judgmental approach into practice. I'm thankful to Professor V.K. Verma, who taught me psychodynamic psychotherapy, and Professor Amy Van Duurzen, who taught me existential psychotherapy. I'm also thankful to Professor John Cox, who taught me the principles of client-centered therapy, and Dr. Mark Pearson, who introduced me to dynamic interpersonal group therapy. I'm also thankful to Dr. Anil Malhotra, who taught me cognitive behavioral therapy, and Dr. Joshi Butcher, who taught me couple counseling and psychosexual therapy. I would also like to thank Professor Eric Pepper, who taught me biofeedback therapy and quite a few stress management techniques. In addition to these, there have been a number of teachers, and I'm grateful to them all for sharing their knowledge with a lot of compassion. Above all, I'm thankful to all my patients who have helped me fine-tune my thinking by sharing their experiences and challenging my judgments. I must confess that a lot of insights discussed in this program are borrowed from a number of scientific studies and also from ancient scriptures and philosophical literature. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to give references of all those sources in these sessions, as the references are too many, and doing so would have broken the continuity of thoughts at several places. I'll be happy to supply the references if one wants to study any particular aspect in greater depths. I hope you enjoyed the sessions. Thank you very much.